What does it mean to be Chinese American at this moment in time? According to the Census Bureau, Chinese Americans have among the highest incomes and the highest levels of education of all ethnic groups in the country. Does Chinese culture, especially in the age of China's breathtaking growth, somehow confer on them a competitive advantage? In a thoughtful new memoir on the Chinese American experience, former Clinton speechwriter and policy advisor Eric Liu examines the interplay of identity, achievement, and culture. He also looks at how the gleaming promise and looming menace of modern China colors our perceptions of Chinese Americans. One Family's Journey and the Chinese American Dream with Eric Liu on Midday. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. U.S. officials say an American two-star general was killed in a suspected insider attack by a member of the Afghan security forces. Pentagon spokesman Rear Admiral John Kirby says others were also hurt.
Many were seriously wounded. Others received only minor injuries. The assailant was killed.
The investigation is still underway. A three-day truce began this morning in Gaza. An Israeli military spokesperson says that nation's ground forces have withdrawn from the Gaza Strip. But speaking on the BBC, a spokesman for Israel's prime minister, Mark Regev, says that Hamas must disarm.
It's crucial that Hamas should not be allowed to rearm, that they can't replenish their stocks of rockets and start digging their tunnels again.
Speaking for the Palestinians, Hanan Ashrawi told the BBC,
Israel will continue this over and over again unless you end the occupation and you lift the blockade.
Ashrawi spoke in Ramallah. The U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit is underway in Washington, and later today, President Obama speaks there. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, he'll announce American businesses have committed more than $14 billion in investments on the continent.
Former New York mayor and billionaire businessman Michael Bloomberg opened the day's program like you would an office retreat.
I would like to invite all of you to take a few seconds to introduce yourself to the person next to you or someone you have not met yet.
His point being, the summit isn't just about speeches and big ideas. It's about networking.
Relationships are what matters, and that's the whole idea here today, to get to know each other, to develop contacts, and to show our mutual respect one for another.
The White House says the investments President Obama will announce during his remarks include clean energy, banking, information technology, and construction. Tamara Keith, NPR News, The White House.
A new report finds that home prices increased 1% in June and were up 7.5% compared to the same month last year. But NPR's Craig Windham says the report shows further moderating in the rate that home prices are rising.
The report by property information firm CoreLogic says the five states with the highest home price appreciation in June were Michigan, California, Nevada, Hawaii, and Oregon. A dozen states posted new highs in the group's home price index, but a number of states are still well below their peak in home prices registered at the height of the housing boom. For instance, home prices in Florida and Nevada are still more than 30% below their highs. CoreLogic's CEO says many homeowners have decided to stay put for now and wait for better economic times and higher prices in the future. Craig Windham, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is down 83 points. The Nasdaq is down 20. This is NPR News in Washington. At this hour, doctors at Emory University Hospital in Atlanta are receiving American aid worker Nancy Wrightbull. She was infected with the Ebola virus while caring for victims in Liberia. Also receiving care at the unique isolation facility in Atlanta, Dr. Kent Bradley, a doctor who was also attending the sick. New research shows that children with autism have normal levels of a hormone that affects social functioning. NPR's John Hamilton reports on a study in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
Several small studies have suggested that levels of the hormone oxytocin might be abnormally low in kids with autism. Oxytocin is often called the love or trust hormone because it increases feelings of trust and empathy. So a team at Stanford tested levels of the hormone in nearly 200 kids, some with autism and some without. Karen Parker, the study's lead author, says the result was a surprise.
Our hypothesis going in was that kids with autism would have the lowest oxytocin levels, and our data blew that out of the water.
Parker says the team did not find a link between oxytocin and autism, but they did find that all children with low levels of the hormone were more likely to have social difficulties. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Unusually hot weather and dry conditions are fueling a blaze that has scorched 60 square miles of forested land and left at least one person dead. The location is central Sweden. About 1,000 people have been evacuated from homes and villages in a region about 90 miles northwest of Stockholm. Italy and France have sent firefighting planes to help. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, with 25 years of Kids Count data on the well-being of America's children at datacenter.kidscount.org.
It's six minutes after 1 o'clock. You're listening to Midday here on your NPR news station, WYPR. Programming today is made possible by iCandy, the optical shop on the Avenue in Hamden, hosting their summer sunglass event featuring fashion designs for the beach and a large selection of sunglass readers for summer bibliophiles. 410-889-0607 or iCandyOP.com. iCandy, Euro style, Baltimore charm. This is your NPR news station, WYPR.
And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Our second hour, Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. The way an American of Chinese ancestry punctuates the words Chinese and American can infer different meanings. For instance, if a man writes Chinese, comma, American, that suggests a person who is cosmopolitan, who spends time in both countries, who feels that identity is an elective matter. Or if he writes Chinese slash American, that's a useful way to describe many first-generation immigrants because it signifies a split identity. Chinese parentheses American, let's see, that infers American-ness as an afterthought, maybe someone who lives in a Chinese enclave who doesn't feel the need to assimilate. Or Chinese American, no punctuation at all, no qualifications, no ambiguities, the two words on equal footing. Of course, for each person, the preference is different because it's often a choice that is deeply rooted in identity and experience. These are some of the insights of my guest in this hour of Midday, Eric Liu, a second-generation Chinese-American who tackles these complexities in a new memoir, A Chinaman's Chance, One Family's Journey and the Chinese-American Dream. Consider this, there are about 4 million Americans of Chinese ancestry in the United States. According to the Census Bureau, Chinese Americans have among the highest incomes and highest levels of education of any ethnic group in the country. Because of these numbers, Chinese Americans are often considered a model minority. They are the strivers among us, the achievers. Or are they? Eric Liu asserts there is more to the story than these statistics will tell you. And beyond that, there's another story to tell, that of the rise and dominance of China itself and of the simultaneous weakening of the American economy. In fact, you could say that we're in the midst of a reverse brain drain in some respects. Since 2010, there's been a dramatic rise in Chinese-born college graduates returning to China to work instead of making a life here in America. Never in history have so many overseas Chinese wanted to go back to China. A lot to talk about here. In this book, Eric Liu considers this, along with what the future of the two countries might hold, a lot to talk about in this hour of the show. Eric Liu is a prolific author. He's a former speechwriter and policy advisor to President Clinton. He's also the CEO and founder of Citizen University, which promotes the art of citizenship. I like that. We're going to hear a little bit about that from him during this hour. And Eric Liu is a correspondent for The Atlantic, the magazine, and a columnist for CNN.com. Again, the latest book is A Chinaman's Chance, One Family's Journey and the Chinese-American Dream. Eric Liu, we welcome you to Midday on WYPR in Baltimore.
Dan, thank you so much for having me.
You know, the title of your book, A Chinaman's Chance, you know, I used to hear my father say that. He's got a Chinaman's chance in hell. He would add those words, too, because that's what that's what that infers, a Chinaman's chance, right?
It is. It's a phrase that, you know, the history of it is as old as Chinese immigration to the United States in the mid-1800s, when significant numbers of laborers started coming here from China, and they were given the most thankless and dangerous and life-threatening tasks, whether it was in laying the railroads or mining mountains. And so this figure of speech arose during those times that if you had a low chance of surviving, if you had basically no chance in hell, you had a Chinaman's chance. And that phrase just stayed in the language. And fast forward 100 years later, when my father arrived in the United States in the late 1950s, somewhere along the way, he heard this phrase. I don't actually know whether he heard it directed at him or simply heard it, you know, in his presence. I'm not even sure which one would have stung more. But my father, being both a real sponge for language and idiom and slang, and also somebody with kind of a playful, ironic sense of humor, he decided pretty early on that he was going to take that phrase, which was meant to harm people like him, and he was going to redirect it, reappropriate it. And so by the time I came around and I was a kid, I also heard the phrase in my household, but I heard it from my dad, and in an ironic way. He would apply it to all kinds of kind of everyday prosaic situations. You know, if I grew up in upstate New York, if the Yankees were down by 5 in the 9th inning with 2 outs, he'd say, oh, they've got a Chinaman's chance of winning this game, right? Right. And he would say things like that just to kind of get my goat and see if he could get a rise out of me. And he delighted in this idea that he was getting to reclaim this phrase that had been intended to hurt him. And I learned a lot from that. It's why I titled the book A Chinaman's Chance. And part of that is about, the act of claiming language is part of the larger act of claiming America. And I think one of the great arcs of story of Chinese Americans in this country has been that process of just redirecting, redeeming everything that's been thrown at us and against us and still moving forward.
So your father took delight in this phrase, in the challenge it presented. He was amused by it.
He was. I mean, he was amused by it, and he was, and he wanted to, again, playfully provoke by using it. Now, I don't know that he so much used it in public. I actually heard of another instance of a public figure using it with a similar spirit of ironic playfulness. Here in Seattle, where I live, the name Wing Luke is well known. He was the first Asian American elected official. He was elected to the Seattle City Council in 1962, the first Asian American elected official in this part of the country, in the entire Northwest. And when he was running for office the first time, somebody, a white constituent, said to him, I think with not a little bit of malice, "Oh, you don't have a Chinaman's chance of winning this election." And Wing Luke, without missing a beat, said, "To the contrary, I'm the only one with a Chinaman's chance of winning this election." and I heard that story from, you know, he died in a plane crash in the 60s. But I heard that story from his sister, Betty, who's still with us and an active part of the Chinese and Asian American community here. And again, she told that story with a bit of devilish pride in the way that her brother's wit was able to neutralize the malice that was directed at him.
Well, when you think of the origin of that term, and you think of Chinese, the first Chinese coming to the United States as indentured servants in the 19th century, right? And then where we are now, to how Americans view Chinese Americans generally, I'm sure some Americans see Chinese Americans as a threat. Others see them as among our best and our brightest, our future and our hope. It certainly seems to support your argument that the treatment of Chinese Americans is always dependent on the strength or weakness of China.
Yeah, absolutely. There's been a mirroring throughout. And when China was weak, as it was 150 years ago, these immigrants, the first Chinese Americans, were subject to incredible levels of abuse. I mean, really from the get-go, and everything from white labor agitation and riots to ordinances that were enacted by cities all across the West that were, you know, sometimes on their face seemingly neutral, but were designed basically to cabin off and punish and and persecute Chinese immigrants. And one of the things that you come to realize when you dig a little bit, not even that deeply, just a little bit deeply into Chinese American history is the ways in which that treatment is very much bound up with how China itself is perceived. And at that time, China was, this essentially a weak nation, and Western powers were beginning to an age of imperialism in China, and essentially were pushing around China. One of the things that you learn during this period is that these immigrants who came to the United States, realizing that they had little in the way of protection from the government of their country back home, over time started doing what Americans do, which was to turn to our system of laws, to the rule of law, to actually seek redress for their grievances. And so one after another, Chinese-American litigants began to take their cases to court. And there's just this incredible, unknown parade of significant legal cases in the late 19th century where Chinese-Americans basically took America to court and said, hold on a second, the 14th Amendment of the Constitution says we get equal protection of the laws. Hold on, the 14th Amendment says that if we're born here in the United States, as the second generation of these immigrants, the kids of these immigrants were, that we are citizens of the United States. We are not to be treated as foreign subjects of another empire. We are citizens. We are Americans. And one after another, Chinese Americans, even when China was weak, began to push using the language and the tools of our Constitution. Now, fast forward again today. China is strong. China is rising. China is so strong and so kind of ascendant that it's creating a great deal of anxiety here in the United States, both economically and increasingly anxiety around national security. And so now you have sort of a mirror image problem, which is not so much that China's weak and so you can push around Chinese immigrants, but China is strong. China is a little bit menacing. And now increasingly Chinese immigrants, Chinese American immigrants, and even second and third and fourth generation people like me are seen in a slightly different light, are seen increasingly in the light of, what you might call yellow peril-ism. And so you wonder in our politics and in the news when, a couple of weeks ago there was a story about hackers from China hacking their way into some of the secret files of Boeing and some of the other American military contractors. And it led this one pundit on cable news to say, to kind of blurt out, my goodness, Chinamen are America's greatest threat right now. In this sort of indiscriminate way, not using the word Chinaman in a malicious way, but B, not particularly distinguishing between Chinese people here, Chinese people there, not particularly caring whether there was any difference, just in one broad brush stroke saying they are a menace. And I think this is something to watch out as much as one would have watched out 150 years ago for persecution.
Eric. Lou, I want to just take a minute here to talk a little bit about your family, because I'm sure you get the question, where are your people from? I think any ethnic group does. When you compare notes with people about their ethnic ancestry, that question comes up. Specifically, a little bit about your family. Would you please, we talked a bit about your father, but a little bit more about him and your mother.
My family's arc and journey of Americanness in some ways begins with my paternal grandfather, my dad's dad, who I never knew and who actually never came to the United States. But his name was Liu Guoyun. And in Mandarin, Liu is the family name, my name. But Guoyun means deliverance of the nation, destiny of the nation. So a pretty intense, high-pressure name.
Yeah.
And he grew up this son of a farmer in rural China at an age when dynastic rule was ending. The Republic of China was emerging, and this period of incredible flux was underway. And he was actually able in his life to try very hard to live up to that name. He joined the armed forces. He went to a military academy. He decided he wanted to be a pilot and to serve this nascent fledgling Republic of China. He ended up being a leader in that Air Force and fighting against the Japanese in the Sino-Japanese War, and later against the communists in the Chinese Civil War. And all my childhood, I grew up with images and stories of this grandfather. As I say, he died before I was born. But the idea of deliverance of the nation was impressed upon me, this idea that if you're part of the Liu family, you have to live up in a way to this name. But for me, as a second-generation son of immigrants who'd grown up here in the United States, that impulse for deliverance and for service and for contribution got channeled to this nation, to wanting to serve this country and be part of the life of this country. And I think that comes as well for my parents. They, as I say, emigrated here in the late 1950s. And, you know, there are a couple of ways to tell their story, Dan. And one way is in this model minority success story way. You know, they both came here with very little money. They both worked hard. They both got educations, and they both managed to build securely middle-class lives working as professionals, you know, for IBM and places like that. But the other way to tell the story is to point out that, you know, in my father's case, of course, he was the son of a general. He came here with great social capital. He came here with great networks and expectations. And that my mother, when she came here, had already graduated from college in Taiwan. Her father was a professor in Taiwan. And so she came here also with social capital and relationships and networks. And I point this out because oftentimes when we talk about Chinese Americans or Asian Americans in general, the stereotype in this country is everybody is a model minority overachiever and, gosh, they're unstoppable. And gosh, why can't other people do as well as they do? And what gets overlooked in that narrative is class, is social class, and the way that so many immigrants, like my parents, came here already with certain advantages built in. And you can say that they didn't blow it, but you can't say that it's just about their gumption and wherewithal and moxie and gosh, why can't brown and black immigrants be as enterprising as these yellow immigrants? That is a narrative that you often hear implicitly in American life. And my family's story, I think, I tell it in part to push against that model minority stereotype. And, you know, my parents raised me in a suburban environment in upstate New York. I grew up on a street called Old English Way in a development called Marywood. And so on some level, you know, I live this very American existence. But I think, you know, as it is with any second generation kid, whether you're Chinese American, whether you are Greek American, whether you are Nigerian American, you're always trying to figure out what the right balance is between holding on to a heritage that is being bequeathed to you, either directly or indirectly, and forging your own identity and moving past that. And those are the reflections that I really spend a good deal of time diving into in the book.
The story of how a Chinese-American family finds its way in the age of China and America, A Chinaman's Chance, One Family's Journey, and the Chinese-American Dream. Eric Liu, the author, our guest in this hour of midday, is founder and CEO of Citizen University, which I'm going to ask him about when we get back from this short break. We'll be right back. This is Midday on WYPR. And welcome back. Dan Rodrigues here on Midday. Our guest this hour, Eric Liu, LIU, served as a White House speechwriter and policy advisor back in the Clinton days. He's founder and CEO of Citizen University. And before we go back to your memoir, Eric, just a little bit about Citizen University. Would you tell us what that's all about?
You bet. Citizen University, Dan, is a nonprofit that's based here in Seattle, where I live, but runs programs nationally. And all our work is about trying to foster a stronger culture of citizenship here in the United States. And our work is partly about civic education in schools and colleges. But it's also about more broadly just our culture, popular culture, the ways that we encounter each other just in everyday life in our communities, and really what the ethics of showing up as a contributing, participating, empowered member of the community really are. And, you know, I think our work has been getting traction because we're at a moment right now in this country where, I mean, so many things are flying apart. Inequality is stretching apart the bonds of community. Demographic change is redefining the question of who is us. And in the midst of all this change, I think people are hungering for some sense of common purpose. And I think one of the things that is so important, again, to me as a second-generation American, as a son of immigrants, I have this very heightened awareness that every single opportunity we have in this country comes with an equal or greater obligation. Every single right that we like to cherish comes with an equal or greater responsibility. And that ethic of opportunity as obligation and rights as responsibilities is something that we try to weave throughout the work of Citizen University.
We were talking at the beginning, well, I was anyway, about hyphenation because and punctuation, because you bring it up. It's a short chapter in your book, A Chinaman's Chance. I find this very interesting. You know, one of the things I wanted to tell you is whenever I speak to people about their ethnic ancestry, people, I mean Americans, you get maybe two or three different reactions to that. Some people don't want to be bothered, don't find it interesting or find it quaint and kind of condescend to talk about it sometimes. Other people seem sad by thinking about the past, especially immigrants, people who arrived here maybe to leave conditions that were less than great. And they don't want to talk about it because it makes them feel bad. And then there's another group that just celebrates the whole thing and can understand, has things completely in balance, what it is to be an American and what it is to be a Jewish American, a Chinese American, Italian American, Greek American. So where do you fall in all of that, Eric?
Well, I think I would,
You're second generation, right?
I am second generation, yeah. So I'm the child of immigrants. And in many ways, I am closest, I suppose, to that third category. But, you know, one of the things that I would emphasize, this point of punctuation, is more than just a trivial grammatical quibble for me. And so, for instance, I never hyphenate. I do not hyphenate Chinese American. And that is really a larger point that I'm trying to make. The way I write it is Chinese space American. American is the noun, and Chinese is the adjective. Chinese is one of numerous adjectives that I could use. I'm a baseball-loving American. I'm a short American. I'm a politically active American. Chinese looms quite large in that list of adjectives for me. But American is the noun. And I think the point of saying it that way is to emphasize two things. I mean, number one, that there are a whole basket of adjectives that compose our identity. But number two, that the noun itself is never a fixed thing. That when you have Chinese Americans entering into American life in our politics, in our pop culture, in business, in education, the very meaning and fabric of Americanness begins to change. And I think that's a great and a beautiful thing. Hyphenation, on the other hand, to me, signifies something else altogether, Dan. When I see something Chinese hyphen American, I think that's appropriately used to signify a transaction between two parties, an interplay between two countries. So Chinese hyphen American trade, or Chinese hyphen American diplomacy, or Chinese hyphen American military tension as between China and the United States of America. That's where I would hyphenate. But in talking about identity and whether my own or that of my fellow citizens, I choose not to hyphenate.
Some people are concerned about it because they're worried about the stereotypes that you addressed before we took our break there. And what about that? Chinese Americans become self-conscious of what Americans, other Americans think about them or assume them to be?
Well, I think, there are numerous stereotypes that are floating out there, and some are outright negative. If your listeners remember the name Win Ho Lee, he was the Chinese-American nuclear scientist working at Los Alamos National Laboratories in New Mexico in the late 90s when suddenly the government of China made some surprising advances in their nuclear weapons research, and all heads swiveled to this guy, Win Ho Lee, and people just assumed that this guy must have been a spy and that he must have been leaking secrets to the Chinese government. And he ended up standing accused by our government, actually by the very administration that I had worked for. And, 80-some charges were thrown at him. This 60-something frail man was thrown into solitary confinement, shackled, and treated like an enemy of the state. Well, turns out he wasn't a spy. Turns out he wasn't guilty of espionage. Turns out almost every one of those charges was dropped. And the year-plus-long saga that he went through was this incredible Rorschach test about how quickly anxiety in America that's centered on race and nation like that can be redirected toward people who are Americans, who are citizens like Win Ho Lee, a naturalized citizen of the United States. So, you know, there are negative stereotypes like that out there about divided loyalties and whether, you know, you can take the Chinese, guy out of China, but not the China out of the Chinese guy. That's one thing. But the other stereotype that increasingly you see is what I think of as damnation by high praise. And a good example of that is this whole tiger mother, tiger parenting phenomenon that the country got all exercised about a year or so ago. And this idea, which got popularized by a book by a Chinese-American author, Amy Chua, and she wrote this sort of tongue-in-cheek, deliberately over-the-top memoir of what an insanely intense and demanding parent she was of her kids, making them practice violin 5 hours a day, you know, setting their stuffed animals on fire if they complained. I mean, she and most of America took her book not tongue-in-cheek, but took it completely at face value and freaked out. Mm-hmm. And Americans began to ask, oh, my gosh, how can we possibly compete with Chinese people? How can we possibly compete with this kind of culture that promotes tiger parenting? And, you know, the thing that I would say about that is two things. Number one, again, the fear of Chinese people became indiscriminate, whether we're talking about Chinese Americans or Chinese in China. It all got rolled up with this larger anxiety in the United States of relative decline and the fact and the sense that China may be eclipsing the United States economically and otherwise. But the second thing that was fascinating about the tiger parenting phenomenon was the way in which, in point of fact, there's nothing about Chinese culture that leads you to tiger parenting. The idea of tiger parenting is as American as a fortune cookie. It's this concoction invented here, labeled here, to kind of convey a sense of something that goes on in the Orient. But really, it's about the psychology and the imaginings that happen here. And so whether you're talking about these outright negative stereotypes or these fearfully positive ones, you know, we've got to watch out, all of us, whether we are Chinese or Asian American or not, to understand the ways in which we are fitting each other into slots of story and not seeing the actual humans in front of us.
I think this is very interesting. I had an opportunity to interview Amy Chua on this show after another book came out, the one she wrote with her husband, The Triple Package. But I want to go back to your book, A Chinaman's Chance, and talk about your parents with regard to this. You say in the book that they did not fit the stereotype of hyper-pragmatic, controlling Chinese parents, what today would be called tiger parents. So tell us about your parents when it came to, say, your studies in school as you were growing up.
You know, Dan, I don't know what the zoological taxonomical opposite of a tiger is, but whatever it is, maybe it's a panda or a puppy, or I don't know. My parents were that. They were just the total opposite of tiger parents. I cannot remember a single instance where they made me do anything. They set a very implicit expectation that I should excel, that I should do well, that I should work hard. That big things were expected of me. But when it came to everyday learning and everyday tasks, they made me do not a thing. And I think that was in part because my mother herself was the only child of this professor of European history in China who had himself come of age at a time when China was trying to reform and embrace more Western ideas. And so my mom grew up already with this sense of you should have more freedom. You should mix influences from cultures. And so when I was a kid, sure, if I got interested in something, if I got interested in drawing, for instance, she would pour it on. She would then get me art lessons. She would get me on the train and take me down to New York City and go to the Metropolitan Museum and go see Cezanne and Degas and Rembrandt and all that stuff. If I showed an interest in violin, you know, I got great lessons. But they did not push anything on me. And what they did as a result was they allowed my own sense of intrinsic motivation to flower and to develop. And, you know, that coupled with, again, that background sense of you're smart, you've got a lot of opportunity, you ought to be doing bigger things, which they didn't have to say outright, but I just felt it all the time. That combination led me to push myself. And in many ways, that's really the way that I'm trying to parent now. I'm I'm the second generation dad of a third generation teenager who is ethnically half Chinese. And my daughter, maybe the most important word in that last sentence is teenager, trying to think about what it means to pass on a sense of both Chineseness and a sense of intrinsic motivation to my daughter is what I'm wrestling with today. But in doing that, I try to learn from the ways in which my parents were untigers.
Well, what about exceptionalism? Americans like to think America is an exceptional country and that individual Americans are individuals and quite exceptional. So in the way what you're describing, your parents would just say, you're capable of doing well, just do well because you have the talent or because of your class, where you are in life. But there was nothing exceptional about getting straight A's, so to speak. Do you know what I mean? You know what I'm getting at? That sort of goes against the grain of what we consider American. You make a big deal when somebody gets an A, right?
Well, these days you get a trophy for just showing up.
Showing up, right.
And, look, I think there's two things going on here. One is about expectations, and one is about exceptionalism. And I actually would like to speak about each somewhat distinctly. In expectations, I do think that I was blessed to have parents who simply suffused me with high expectations. I cannot point to a single instance where they said, you must or shall do this. It was just this generally high sense that you ought to apply yourself and be the most that you can be. And it's a waste not to. I think the most stinging word that I ever heard growing up in Chinese and Mandarin is mei you yong, which just literally means useless. There's nothing I wanted to be less than useless. And to put it affirmatively, there's nothing I wanted to be more than to be useful to society, to community, to country. And so I think setting high expectations is something that we've got to do in this society here in the United States now in a way that isn't just about test scores, but is more about, a social compact with the rising generation that says, okay, we're not going to helicopter parent you, but we are going to expect that you're going to push yourself. And that requires something called trust, which I think has been diminishing in the way that parenting has unfolded in this country over the last generation. The thing about exceptionalism, though, Dan, I really want to return to, because this phrase American exceptionalism has a bit of a dirty ring to it, I guess, now. Over this last decade of wars, it seemed to get a bad reputation because the phrase was used to justify those wars, that America has an exceptional mission in the world and we will, by force of arms, bring freedom and democracy to places that don't have it. And look, I get that. I get the reflex that some people have against the phrase American exceptionalism. And yet, I believe fully that there is something exceptional and indispensable about this country. And it's not only the fact that this country is the only place on earth that, to quote Lincoln, is dedicated to a proposition, right? We have nothing to bind us together in all of our ethnic and religious and other forms of diversity. We have nothing to bind us together except a creed on paper, except the creed of citizenship that you can find in the preamble to the Constitution or the Declaration or Gettysburg or I Have a Dream or the Seneca Falls Declaration. This simple creed, and that is an exceptional thing. But the nature of that exceptionalism is, to me, that it creates an exceptional burden. It's not exceptionalism in the sense of, hey, let's pat ourselves on the back and really thump our chest and say we're number one, we're awesome. Actually, what it means is because we have this creed that this country has continually not fully lived up to, we bear this great burden, this exceptional burden of actually nudging our practices in everyday life to closer alignment with our stated ideals of freedom, liberty, and equality. That's an exceptional thing. And the other thing that is exceptional about this country that I would proudly say is that our point is to take influences and cultures and genes and bloodlines and memes and ideas from every other part of the planet and fuse them into new and unpredictable hybrids. And so, for instance, when we think about China's rise, I'm not freaked out about China's rise. I don't care how big their GDP is going to get. Because I think the United States retains this deep, enduring competitive advantage, which I summarize this way. America makes Chinese Americans. China does not make American Chinese. China does not want to, does not know how to, is not interested in taking people from other parts of the world, welcoming them, empowering them, fusing them into society, integrating them, and enabling them to redefine Chineseness. That's not their deal. But our deal is to do exactly that, to allow and empower newcomers to redefine Americanness as we enter into the stream of American life. So, I think that is exceptional. But again, it creates an exceptional burden for us to live up to it, for us to not blow it, and for us to retain the open, wonderful, wild hybridity of our culture and our society.
And I would just add our responsibility or our need to try to keep Chinese Americans in this country and to
Absolutely.
Keep them from going back that reverse brain drain I talked about earlier. Well, why don't Absolutely. We talk about that after our break here, Eric? I'm enjoying this. Eric Liu, LIU, is our guest. A Chinaman's Chance, One Family's Journey, and the Chinese American Dream is published by Public Affairs. That's Eric Liu's book. Eric's with us for the remainder of the hour. I'll tell you how to reach us if you'd like to share some thoughts. Perhaps you're Chinese American and you would like to talk with Eric about that. 410-662-8780. Toll free long distance for the midday show, 866-661-9309. Our midday email address is midday@wypr.org. There have always been two entwined sources of our nation's appeal, the vision of America as a land of unbounded economic opportunity, and the promise of America as a land defined not by blood or ethnicity, but by a race-blind creed of equality and liberty. We have often failed to live up to that vision and that promise. But what marks this country as exceptional is that we have always held it as a betrayal of national purpose to fail, and have thus always strived to fail less. A quote here from Eric Liu's book, A Chinaman's Chance, One Family's Journey, and the Chinese American Dream. Eric, so we were talking just about that before the break, and I brought up this the question of, the country, this nation produces Chinese Americans, as you pointed out, but many of your generation, second generation Chinese Americans, are going to China to start ventures or work for big American companies. That's that reverse brain drain we talk about. We also see many overseas Chinese who come here to be educated, graduating from our colleges, going back to do business there. And that looks very challenging or, there's something about that bothers people, actually scares some people about that in regard to the rise of China, that we're educating Chinese and Chinese Americans and they're going to help China, not this country.
Well, it's troubling to me, and it's, there is a contemporary story that's certainly happening with large numbers of students from China coming here, getting educations, higher education, and then not staying here.
Right.
But I would even rewind, a generation previously. So in my own family, I talk about in this book, my uncles, my father was one of six brothers, all of whom, in their late teenage years, made their way to America and got educations and began to work in American institutions, whether it was universities or big companies like Bell Labs or IBM. And one by one, three of these five uncles, as the late 80s came around and Taiwan had risen from the, post-war devastation to essentially become what was then called one of the Asian Tigers. There was an incredible economic boom in Taiwan. And one by one, my uncles started to look around and realize that there was actually more opportunity for them there, back where they had come from, than here in the United States, that though they were doing fine here in the United States, they had, each in his own way, hit something of a bamboo or a glass ceiling. They weren't getting fully appreciated for the full breadth of their talent and ability and potential to contribute. And so they went back. And these uncles, after going back, followed a remarkable arc of career and life that in many ways lived up to their father's name, the name of my grandfather, Liu Guoyun, which meant to deliver the nation. And they helped the Republic of China as university presidents and major business people and leaders in their politics and their government. And on the one hand, I can say selfishly as a, you know, Liu family story, that's awesome. I'm so proud of my uncles and what they've done. But as the story of an American, from the vantage point of being an American, I look at that story and I see that as the failure of my nation. I see that as the failure of the United States to not have held, been magnetic enough or open enough to make it so that my uncles would have thought not at all about ever leaving here, but felt like their fullest opportunities and sense of potential could be realized here. So fast forward to today. Again, this is happening all around us. And mainland China, of course, is many orders of magnitude larger and more magnetic than Taiwan had been in the 80s and 90s. And so, yes, there are a lot of both second, third, beyond Chinese-American folks like me who are going to China now and seeking their fortune. There are plenty also of Chinese immigrants who are coming here, people like my parents, whether coming from the mainland or coming from Taiwan, staying here, getting an education here, maybe working here for a little while, but then getting drawn back. And again, I see that as the failure of our nation, that we are not open enough and that we are not creating enough opportunity to compel or to impel these people to stay here in the United States and contribute to this country.
What's going on there? Why is that? Is it discrimination? Is it a bias, prejudice? What is it?
No, I think it's a mixture of things. I mean, look, the fact is there is excitement and opportunity in China. And if you are certainly if you're an immigrant from mainland China and you're getting an education here in the United States, chances are, compared to, you know, 99% of your fellow Chinese citizens, you've got some connections, you've got some wherewithal, and you are probably highly tempted to bring all that back and bring your American degree and really leverage it back in China. I understand that. That is appealing.
But where's the failing on our part? I understand the attraction over there, Eric, but where's the failing on the part of the U.S.?
The failing on the part of the U.S. is, I mean, systematically, right? I mean, it's a failure of our immigration policy not to want to make it easier for these students to stay here, become permanent residents, and ultimately citizens. It's a failure of our business and academic institutions to not be doubling down and creating opportunities and incentives for this talent to stay here, to apply themselves here, to get opportunities to lead and to innovate here. It's a failure to some extent also just, again, of our wider society to not fully make these immigrants from China feel like this is where they can be their fullest selves, that they can express their voice and their creativity and their identity in arts, in politics, in business, in whatever it may be. And I think, you know, to put it in the affirmative, rather than just saying it's a failure, we all have to do better. We all have to do better to make this a more magnetic place. When we have newcomers, whether they're from China or whether they are the child migrants at the southern border, we all have to start creating a culture here that says, you know what, we do want the most talented and able and ambitious and risk-taking people from other societies. We do want them here. We do want them to be participants and contributors to every aspect of American society. And I don't think we're doing that enough, you know, because we're in an age of fear and restrictionism and isolationism.
Yeah, I mean, what is the so-called debate over immigration policy in the United States, or what to do with, you know, thousands of children who are basically refugees, trying to escape violence in areas of Central America? What does that message send to the greater world?
Yeah. I mean, it says America is closing not just its borders, it's closing its sense of ambition. It's closing its sense of confidence. The fact that 5,000 kids who themselves are, exceptional in their own peer cohort, that they were willing to take the risk to come up here, this group of kids is threatening the very fabric of American society and our sense of stability as a country and the rule of law, says to me and says to, I think, a lot of people around the world that we are lacking a bit in our confidence in our ability to welcome and integrate and capitalize upon newcomers. And I think, again, forget about just the southern border. We have 11 million undocumented people who are our friends, our neighbors, our coworkers, our fellow students in our society. And the fact that this country, this Congress, cannot really figure out what to do and how to actually reform our systems so that these people get out of limbo, people who are already contributors, who already essentially in many ways live like citizens, mm-hmm. pay taxes, contribute, volunteer, advocate, that we can't find a way clear for them to be fully embraced in our society is, again, a sign of our diminishing confidence in ourselves.
Okay, then I'm going to read a quote from your book and then ask you if this is wishful thinking. You say, quietly, America is becoming more other-directed, more mindful of mutuality. Loudly, China is becoming more selfish, more short-term, less filial, and more self-seeking.
Yeah, I think this is the I think it's more than wishful thinking. One of the arguments of my book, Dan, is that when we talk about welcoming Chinese Americans, integrating Chinese Americans, or for that matter, you know, immigrants from anywhere in the world, it's not simply a, hey, you know, we will have a welcome sign up and we won't actually shut you out. We won't actually do as we did 140 years ago and exclude you by law. But welcoming is, while necessary, completely insufficient. Beyond simple the act of simply welcoming, what we've got to do is accept the fact that when Chinese Americans are fully participating in every aspect of American life, the cultural styles that we bring, which are styles that are more about context and community than simply the bright and shiny individual, that are contexts of relationship and obligation and not just about don't tread on me, that are cultural values of thinking about the long term and with an arc of multiple generations rather than just thinking about today and yesterday and maybe tomorrow, that these values, as they become infused in American life, change America. And you see this in people like Tony Hsieh, for instance, the entrepreneur who founded Zappos.com. Mm-hmm. On one level, this guy is just the classic American.com entrepreneur. He started this this website to sell shoes online when everybody told him that was crazy. Nobody would buy shoes online. They want to try them on. And he was right. He stuck to his guns and he did this venture and he became extremely wealthy. Well, what has he done with this wealth? He's investing $300 million of his own fortune into revitalizing downtown Las Vegas, where his company is now located. And what he's trying to do is to create a sense of community, bringing in artists and social programs and innovators and incubators into this dilapidated part of the desert to rebuild and foster a sense of mutuality and reciprocity and community. And that, to me, is very Chinese. There is this Chinese ethic in the way that he's being an American. And if we can embrace that times 1,000, times 4 million, then we will be stronger. And it won't simply be that we're saying to immigrants from China or anywhere else, welcome, now try to become like white people. Welcome, now try to act like a WASP. Mm-hmm. Instead, we're saying, welcome, now be yourselves. And by being yourselves, change the larger idea in America of who is us.
Eric Liu, LIU, is founder and CEO of Citizen University. More information about Citizen University on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. He is the author of an earlier book, The Accidental Asian, a correspondent for The Atlantic and a columnist for CNN.com. The book we've been talking about is a memoir, Eric Liu's A Chinaman's Chance, One Family's Journey and the Chinese American Dream, published by Public Affairs. Thank you very much, Eric. It was a pleasure to have you on the show.
Dan, I really appreciate this conversation. It was great to visit with you.
It was great. Thank you very much. I hope we get to speak again sometime.
Look forward to it.
All right. Bye-bye. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in to our midday today. I hope you enjoyed the program. For our engineer today, Luke Spicknall, we thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you again soon.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Brian Gilbert, Tyler Downey, Anna Muckerman, and Evelyn Feeney. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at wypr.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.